Hello and welcome to Inside Education. We're online at insideed.com. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on this week's programme.
You don't just pick these tests out of the air. They have to be standardised and they have to be selected very carefully, the items that are used on it.
We take a look inside the world of standardised tests and see how they're designed. And in a week which saw the death of one of the pioneers of drama education, we discuss the legacy of Dorothy Hethcote. But we begin with a new series in which Barry Hennessy looks behind the international PISA test to tell us more about its origins, its standing and its meaning. He begins this week with an overview of the test.
Over recent years, the discourse surrounding educational achievement both in Ireland and across the developed world has changed. Parents, the media and some policymakers increasingly demand league tables both for individual schools and the educational system as a whole. The onset of Ireland's economic crisis led to renewed criticism of aspects of our education system which are perceived, rightly or wrongly, to be failing the students of today and the society, or should that be the economy, of tomorrow. State examination results in maths and the sciences in particular are scrutinised by a league of commentators, all looking for evidence that something is badly wrong in Irish classrooms. For the last year, one test in particular has been at the heart of the national debate on standards in our schools. PISA is an international assessment of reading, maths and science carried out in up to 16 states connected to the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development. In this series, we intend to take a critical look at a test whose findings are often taken as gospel, both by educators and policymakers. We'll hear from those involved in administering the tests and those who criticise them and attempt to understand why 15-year-olds in some countries seem destined to outperform those in others. Jude Cosgrove is Ireland's representative on the PISA 2012 governing board. So just what does PISA attempt to do?
It was designed specifically to measure the types of knowledge and skills that students are able to demonstrate in or around the end of compulsory schooling, that is, at around age 15. Now, because the OECD wanted, and its member countries wanted to try to get a measure of knowledge and skills that was relevant to future participation in education, work and society, I think it's very important to note that the PISA tests don't attempt to measure what's covered in the curricula of participating countries, but they try rather to get at a very broad, real-life literacy type of approach to measuring knowledge and skills in three key areas: reading literacy, mathematics and science.
Svein Sjoberg is Professor of Science Education at the University of Oslo. He argues that PISA cannot be seen as an impartial test, but rather one that is anchored in the particular values and aims of the OECD.
OECD is not education, it's actually economy. So this is actually an organization which has economic competition and development in a free market economy as the prime target. In fact, that is why we have the OECD. And so when they are entering into the educational area, it has, of course, to do with economical matters like efficiency, accountability, do we get value for money? So that's the prime concern. It's not education per se, which is the concern. They are interested, first of all, in basic reading, in basic literacy, which is, reading, being able to understand text. And then it is mathematics, and then it is science. So these three main areas are their concern. Which, of course, also is at the neglect of everything else that we find important in schools.
So just how are the international PISA tests designed? Svein Sjoberg again.
First of all, it's understanding a text. So it's and quite often it's a heavy and a written text, which is just a minor part of the kind of challenges you meet in real life. But it's said to be authentic texts, and of course, it might have been authentic in one culture at one time, but then, as you say, it's been translated, and very often word by word, to other countries, other contexts. What was meant to be a context-rich test is, in fact, context-free. It's out of context. It doesn't fit the context of any of the countries taking part in the test.
I see this as an issue somewhat separate to translation. And in fact, before the content of the test is finalised, there are two major steps to establish the content of the test. The first is the development and agreement on a framework or a blueprint, if you like, as to what the assessment should be trying to measure. For example, what types of content areas in mathematics, let's say, what relative emphases in each of these content areas, that kind of thing. And then once the items themselves are developed, before they're even chosen for inclusion in the test, every country has a chance to rate every item in terms of its accessibility, relevance to 15-year-olds, overall priority for inclusion, so a number of ratings. And those ratings are taken into account along with the statistical properties of the questions before the sample of questions is finalised.
Jude Cosgrove. Much of the controversy surrounding PISA centres on the publication of league tables for the countries that take part. These league tables can have major implications on debate surrounding education in the media and among policymakers. Svein Sjoberg.
I don't want PISA to go away, but we need to be able to put PISA on a place where it belongs as one out of many inputs of information that says something about our schooling system. In many countries, it has simply taken too much place in the public. So it's forming the public opinion about the quality of the school, and it's forming the policy, and those who make curricula try to make curricula that fits the PISA logic with the weight on the competences and so on. So the political influence has been and will continue to be tremendous and just out of proportion with what it should be, I think.
I think the overemphasis on the league tables and the sort of horse race type of approach is very damaging. I think the major area is the issue of capturing trend information. In other words, from cycle to cycle, ascertaining whether achievement within a given country has changed. And I think that is related to the fact that there is a natural tension in PISA between providing an innovative and policy relevant assessment with keeping it the same to measure change across time.
And Barry will continue his series on PISA on next week's programme. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website insideed.com. You can contact the programme by emailing insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. On the 8th of October last, one of the pioneers of drama education passed away aged 85. Dorothy Hethcote, who was appointed Member of the Order of the British Empire, MBE, in the 2011 Birthday Honours for services to drama as education, revolutionised the use of drama in education through a variety of pioneering techniques. In order to find out more about her work and her legacy, I spoke to Annie Murphy, who teaches drama education to student teachers in the Merino Institute of Education. I began by asking Annie, who was Dorothy Hethcote?
I find it odd, probably, first of all, to think of her as a was at this stage, because for so long we were able to say about Dorothy, you know, to the students here, particularly, I suppose, in the college, that this is a woman who's still practicing. She's in her 80s. She died only very recently at 85. But what I've learned about her anyway since her passing is that she was very much a family person, a good cook, and somebody who's interested in calling into the neighbours and all of that. That's a side to her that we wouldn't have known, obviously, because as a teacher, the Dorothy that I got to know was the first pioneer of what has become known now as drama in education, or drama as education.
And what's the difference between drama in education or drama as education?
I think now, actually, where those terms become distinct is that perhaps at the time when Dorothy was trying to break into education, if you like, the term in became very important, like to get drama literally recognised and get in there. But now things have moved on since then, and I suppose now we see that drama itself is a form of education as any other arts area is. And Dorothy would have been particularly strong on that, particularly probably when she came up with this idea of Mantle the Expert, which was a whole approach to education. So rather than it being just sort of a strategy that could be used as part of drama, she looked at using drama across the curriculum, drama as an approach to education.
And this idea of mantle of the expert, I've heard a lot about it. What exactly does it mean in practice?
Really, it's about children running an enterprise, and they operate as though they're experts in a particular field. And they get commissions from an external client. I'll give you a practical example of what might take place. Let's imagine the children are in an organisation that organises sporting events. This is one I've actually done recently. So they're experts at organising sporting events. And they get they might get then, say, for example, a letter asking them to organise a national championship, soccer championship for young girls and boys. And they're given a certain budget that they have to work from. And obviously, in receiving the letter in the first instance, you have them reading for information. So you might come in, the teacher would obviously take on a role. And that's another thing I can talk about in a minute is Dorothy was the first to talk about this idea of teacher in role. But the teacher would come in role as perhaps the manager of the organisation, say. And she might say, you know, I've received this letter. Let's just have a look at the second paragraph, because in that it tells us what exactly our commission is here. So all of a sudden you have they're reading with a purpose. So we're not saying I need you to read the second paragraph there and we're going to pick out the difficult words. We're reading for a purpose. And so they're reading for meaning, which is what we're always trying to get at anyway. Later then they might be told, they might start working on their ideas, generating ideas. How would you attract young girls, particularly maybe to soccer? So this was something we're working on recently. So they're trying to think, you know, what ways can we do this? So then whilst they're working on that, the teacher actually almost acts as somebody who's throwing in these curveballs, who comes back with another sort of a problem. So that's the teacher's role. So the teacher then comes back and says, I know you're currently working on generating, say, an ad campaign that's going to go on the internet. But actually, I've just received this fax, and they all get a copy of the fax or email, and it's from the Fire Safety Authority, and we're actually having an inspection next Tuesday here at our company. So I know you're terribly busy with this other particular commission. So all of a sudden then we have to shift the frame, and we go into talking about how we must make sure that our office, our environment is fully equipped for this. So one thing we learned the other day was like how to use a fire extinguisher, because we were afraid that when the fire inspectors came out that they would ask us, first of all, the different kinds of fire extinguishers we had in the building, and secondly, how to use them. So all of a sudden we had learned this pass idea, you press, aim, squeeze and sweep. And these are the kinds of things that when they learn it in that context, they can actually, it's more immediate, isn't it? Because they're finding out that in a couple of days we're going to have an inspection, so we really need to know this stuff, guys. You know, we're working here together as a team, so let's just recap. You know, so we're finding this information because it's actually needed. So another thing, say, that might happen then is just as we might have planned out our maths sort of side of things with our budget for this particular event, we'll get further correspondence. It's generally letters because we're obviously trying to focus in on literacy at times, but we might get some other form of correspondence to say that actually our budget has been cut and we now need to work within a tighter budget. So for example, we need to cut 20% off all staff related costs, and then non-staff related costs need to be cut by 12%. So you can see then how, again, it looks to the outsider as though we're just trying to do maths, but to the children, this is part of the reality of the fiction, if you get, I know that's a contradiction in terms, but suddenly now we have to work on that. So really what happens is there's several tasks presented to the children within this fictional frame, and there's this fictional client who's sending us those. In our case, the commission, or the one I'm talking about there, we were imagining that the client was the Football Association of Ireland. And of course, then we had the whole situation where there are others actually who might be trying to get this particular commission as well. So we have to make sure that ours is the very best it can be. So you're always going for quality. There's things you can get in there very easily, like, for example, environmental awareness and care. We could be very aware that we actually are using, you know, too much paper in our publications. We need to actually separate our waste. I notice everything's going into the one bin. We might, you know, decide that we have lights on at night, which is a security measure. But actually, what's the impact on the environment and on our costs here as running the building? So everything becomes part of this sort of story, if you like.
So it sounds like then by pretending to be an expert in an area, you actually learn a lot about the particular area or about lots of different areas.
Yeah, that's right. And often as well, like they'd say that the children are operating a head taller, you know, to use Vygotsky's term, because once we say you're experts and we're treating them as such, they become on a level then that's equivalent to the teacher. And to go back to the idea of, I mentioned teacher and role a moment ago, and Dorothy coined that phrase, and actually a number of the terms that are now used frequently in the drama world came from Dorothy herself. But teacher and role obviously is where the teacher takes on a role within the fiction. Now, back in the 60s when Dorothy was talking about this stuff, this must have been revolutionary and also very challenging and terrifying. And I suppose it still remains a challenge for teachers today to take on that role. But as you say, by entering into this world, they are learning a lot about that world. But actually, sometimes the world is just the frame, and there's several things that can happen beyond it. For example, we generally would encourage the children to work collaboratively. We're never working in a competitive Dragon's Den style enterprise. So there's those kind of skills that are being developed at the same time.
Did she ever visit Ireland, Annie?
She did, yes. She was here in 2009, actually. The Association for Drama and Education in Ireland was established in 1999. And to celebrate its 10th year, there was a conference held in Trinity College in Dublin, and Dorothy came over to that. She was the keynote speaker. She also, we got great mileage out of her when you think about it, a woman at the time, she was 83. She conducted masterclasses with postgraduate students. She also ran workshops. And then on the main day, let's say, we brought in a group of children from Knocklyon, and she did this mantle, the expert, on front of all of the delegates. So we got to see it for real from the woman who invented it. So that was something very special. She worked alongside Cecily O'Neill.
Why do you think she was so influential?
I suppose, as I said, like at the time, it must have been such a challenge in the 60s to start saying now the teacher has to take on a role and pretend all of the time. But initially, actually, it was probably met with quite a lot of resistance. It was not only from people outside of drama, but from people within the community who thought, well, this isn't theatre. It's what is this kind of strange process? So, but I think that the reason for the influence might have been that, you know, when something is as effective as her work was, then people have to sit up and take note. And I suppose maybe part of the way it was communicated was that she was actually filmed, and she was filmed not working with children who were perfectly well behaved. She went into very, very tough situations and showed children becoming absolutely engaged with this, and to use her own language then, they actually became obsessed with it. Okay? They got this healthy obsession with whatever they were working on, and didn't realise, for example, that this was like we were targeting, say, literacy or numeracy or whatever, that they just got so involved in it that they wouldn't have seen what happened. So I think then, because that was videoed then, it meant that it went internationally, and then she began to speak and was an invited guest to many countries, and I suppose that's the way the word spread then.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like she's moved education a long way away from the idea of the school play being the only acting that children do.
Certainly, and having said that, Mantle the Expert is recognised as a form of theatre. It just involves, I suppose, a shift in our perception of what theatre is. Is theatre something that happens on a stage and where we all come out and bow at the end? Or is it something where the children can be invited to take part and become the story makers? And certainly Dorothy brought us to that way of thinking that it's the children are all the time adding to the story, that it's you and I, actually, to use language that she would have used, is that it's you and I mixing this around together. It's a we setting, you know, it's not about the teacher directing a bunch of children. It's their ideas mixed in.
And Annie, finally, at a time when we hear about the need to raise standards of numeracy, literacy, science and foreign languages and so on in our education system, why do you believe that drama in education is important? What role does it have to play?
Well, I suppose an answer that you might expect me to say would be that, well, drama can do all of those things, and you know, we can address it through drama, we can use drama as a methodology. So that could be one possible reply. But I think really what we should be looking at is, rather than sort of saying, you know, now we need to look at maths and literacy and numeracy and science and modern languages because that's what the economy demands, we should actually look at a far broader thing than that. What we need are creative people. We don't have the first clue what's happening next week. Even in the economy, we don't know. So therefore, how can we decide that this is what's right? So really, all art is a way, it's a way of knowing. And we can't decide that actually what we need now is a little bit of that and a lot of the other. And when we've more time, we'll come back to the art side of things, because we just don't know. We don't know what's happening. We can't plan for the future. And I think it's, in a way, it's a limiting kind of idea. We're sort of saying that we'll try and imagine what the future is going to be like. We're going to need scientists. But sure, we didn't see any of this, what's happening at the moment. We didn't see any of that coming. And we had people who were very literate and very numerate working in positions of power. But we still ended up in a mess. So actually what we probably need are people who can think laterally, divergent thinkers, creative people who, no matter what the future throws at them, that they're able to deal with it. And I suppose that's where drama fits in, not just drama, but the arts. That's where the arts come into it. The arts are about understanding the human condition. You know, it's about actually being in. It's one of the arts are one of those areas where you're inside being a human. Like in drama, we play around with why people behave as they do. And sure, that's the stuff of the future, because it's always going to be about dealing with a new reality. So I guess that's where drama fits at the moment.
And that was Annie Murphy of the Merino Institute of Education paying tribute to the legacy of Dorothy Headcote. Finally this week, we take a look at the art and science of test design. Many teachers use standardised tests such as the MICRA-T, the SIGMA-T, the Drumcondra Primary Reading Test and the Drumcondra Primary Mathematics Test. Those tests are intended to measure something that is invisible, such as reading or mathematical knowledge. But how do the people who write those tests decide what questions to put in them? And why? Well, people who practice the science of measurement are psychometricians, and this week we're going to find out some more about their work. I've been speaking to Dr. Erica Doyle about the world of psychometrics. Erica Doyle is a registered psychologist and a research fellow with the National Longitudinal Study of Children in Ireland. Her background is in child development, dyslexia and cognitive testing. As well as being involved in a number of research projects in the Children's Research Centre in Trinity College Dublin, she runs a private practice in these areas and runs parenting courses. I began by asking Erica Doyle to explain what psychometrics is.
Psychometrics is probably, I suppose, most people would know it as maybe, it's a personality test or it's an IQ test or whatever. They're usually standardised assessment tests that are used by psychologists or educationists to kind of get a measure of something that is, in some ways, you know, not obvious or not, you know, something that's not touchable, let's say. So how do you measure, you know, ability or in various areas and that type of thing? And people probably don't understand that, you know, you don't just decide, you know, you don't just pick these tests out of the air. They have to be standardized and they have to be selected very carefully, the items that are used on it. So usually a psychometric test is standardized on a normative sample. So there's a large group of people who they've been tested on, and depending on the age that it's appropriate for, there will be tests done on the, so for, say if you're thinking about children's IQ or whatever, there will be samples with the various age groups to see how they perform on various items. Now, if items aren't, let's say, doing what you might think they do, maybe they should be dropped. So they're going to be tested thoroughly with different samples.
So if we go for, many teachers would use a reading test and a maths test at the end of the year usually, and it would be a standardised test. So the items that are in that test, you know, that the children are asked to do, how are they developed?
Well, what they would do is they would see what curriculum is. Obviously, you're not going to teach to the test, that's the whole point, but you will teach to a general ability of that test. And they will look at the items to see whether they're reliable or valid. So if you gave those items again, say next week, will the child perform similarly on that or will they fail away? And are they actually testing what they're supposed to test?
And say for the first one there, the reliability, you would hope that the children would get the same result whether they do it this week or next week or in a month's time.
Yes. Well, obviously children are going to, if they're being taught, they will progress. But for kind of the normative testing, you would take a sample of children and maybe test them every couple of weeks on the same items to see, okay, are they performing within, say, maybe a 10-point range or whatever. You talk about confidence intervals and standard errors of measure and that type of thing. I won't go into that, but if the children are, say, performing in or around, say, usually they get a score of 96 and maybe the next week they get 92 and the next week they get maybe 102, that's fine. But if they're scoring 34 one week, 52 one week and 110 the next week, you know something's wrong here. And, you know, is it that this item isn't right, or, you know, is it something else that's affecting the performance of that group?
Okay, and the validity then, the other thing you said is it measuring what we set out to measure? So, for example, if you have a maths test, maybe, if it's actually testing reading, ability, then it's a problem.
Yes, obviously it has to be specific to the area you're testing. So you have to be sure that, you know, you're just testing, say, the maths concepts or something, and you're not testing something else that might be on the periphery. So, I mean, that's a whole science in itself, as you can imagine. So psychologists or researchers who are using psychometric tests don't just dream up tests. They usually use standardised tools if they're available for what they're trying to target, and ones that have been shown to be reliable, valid, and have a good standing in their field over time. So I suppose examples of psychometric tests that we would use would be things like, say, the Bayley Scales, which is a developmental test for children on the younger age group, say 0 to 3 years roughly. And then psychologists obviously would use IQ tests like the Stanford-Binet or some of the Wexler tests people may be familiar with to get the IQ, and that'll give you a profile of both verbal and non-verbal ability. And then other standardised tests, say of reading, the Sigmaty and things like the Drum-Condra are used kind of regularly by teachers just to see what performance, how the children are performing over their year. Usually more sophisticated reading tests are used by psychologists, like some of the Wyatt or the Wexler tests.
Because they would allow some diagnosis as
would,
well.
Well, they'd just give you a lot more data. It'd be a bigger battery of tests, and it would take longer, obviously, and you're doing it on an individual basis, because obviously the Sigmatys and that are done in a classroom situation, and they're just giving you an idea of a score for what the children have covered, let's say, in that year.
And they're called standardised tests. What does it mean that they're standardised?
It means they're standardised. In other words, when they have been tested on a sample, the sample is to reflect the general population. So you're going to have the right age range that you want to target, different level of ability. You're going you may have to have some children in there with disability or with language issues, so that you get an idea of the scores of how other people are going to perform in the general population.
And that was Dr. Erica Doyle from Trinity College Dublin. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us on insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to my guests, Annie Murphy and Erica Doyle, and to Barry Hennessy for his PISA series. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.